one of the most important tenets of the Buddha's teachings, one of the most important things to understand about what the Buddha understood and asks that we come to understand, one of the most important truths is that our happiness is determined by what we do. We determine our own happiness. It's what we do that determines our happiness. Our happiness is determined by our actions. Now this is very much an insight because we tend not to subscribe to that notion, that truth. We may, particularly as we come to practice, think, well, that is true, but within our minds, I know within my mind, there's a fairly swift current of thought that would posit that my happiness is dependent on things outside of myself. Not on what I do, but what others do. Not on what I do, but the way my body is. The way the world is. You know, we tend to believe that, you know, if things are the way that we want them to be, we'll be happy. You know, and that really starts, as the Buddha speaks to in the chant we did tonight, you know, as the Buddha tells us, and as we're asked to reflect on, you know, but this body is subject to aging, death, and illness. You know? And that's something that we have to understand. And because we don't truly ascribe to the understanding that our happiness is dependent on our actions, as we face the aging of the body, as we experience it, as we consider our imminent death, we perceive that this isn't so good, you know? That my experience isn't an experience that will allow me to be happy. Because of this experience, I won't be able to be happy. Because of this experience, I won't be able to be happy. This is what we believe, right? This is what inside we believe. In that chant, the Buddha says, or we're asked to chant, you know, all beings are subject, we're subject to sickness, aging, death, and we'll be separated from all that's dear and appealing to us. All the people, all the things that we want, all the things that we have. But we believe that, you know, we'll be happy when we're joined with the things that are dear and appealing to us. When we have the things that are dear and appealing to us, if it's the people or the jobs or the possessions. But the truth of it is that we will be separated from all these things. Does that mean we can't be happy in this life? Does it mean we can't be happy because we're going to get sick and age and die? Well, the teachings would suggest no. We're subject to these truths of sickness, aging, death, and separation, but what we're asked to understand and reflect on, as the chant suggests that we do, is that our happiness is determined by our actions. Our happiness is determined by actions. All that we are is determined by our actions. We're born of our actions. So, if our happiness is determined by our actions, and again, you know, we have to begin to start to see that and appreciate that. Because once we do, then we start to do more about our actions. You know, we start to really pay a lot more attention to our actions. And because if we don't really believe our actions are going to lead us to happiness, then we won't really do much in terms of learning to understand which actions lead to suffering and which actions lead to happiness. I'm going to die anyway. I'm going to get sick. Everybody's going to leave me. So it's all for naught, right? It's one of my favorite patterns of thinking. So we have to understand that our happiness is determined by our actions. So that begins with what we sometimes call our mundane actions. Our mundane actions, which we could think of, mundane as kind of a bit of a pejorative, I guess. But that just sort of means our daily, day-to-day, moment-to-moment actions, our deeds, what we do. So, for instance, coming to the class tonight, or the action of listening to the talk. So, ostensibly, we decided to take this action to come here tonight because we want to be happy. So this action that we take, ostensibly, we're taking because we understand to some extent that our actions are going to determine our happiness. So we say, well, I'm going to come to this class instead of doing this, that, or the other thing. Or yesterday's retreat. A lot of things that we could have done other than come to the retreat. But we understood that this was important, and we're going to take this action because this was going to lead to our happiness. Sometimes it's a subtraction. Sometimes we say, this person, hanging out with this person really isn't in my best interests, even though, I really like, going over to their place and listening to their stereo. They have a lot of good records, but, it's really not in my best interests. This person doesn't treat me well and, doesn't honor me. I need to maybe let go of this person. Or we may understand that, spending time with this person really isn't my best interests. This is an action. Maybe it's about being generous to a parent or doing something for a child. And we understand that this is an action that will lead to happiness. So we take those actions. So those are our mundane actions. And then there's what we sometimes call our noble actions or our transcendent actions. And those are the actions with regard to our minds. So it's like, what do we do with our minds? What do we do with our minds? Because ultimately, that's what determines our happiness, because what we do with our minds is going to determine the quality of the actions that we take. In the end, it's where we put our minds. We need to be able to put our minds in the right places, or in the places that, or in the place that is going to be in our best interests in our effort to find happiness, or the place where happiness is. I mean, that's the Buddha's teaching. It's what you do with your mind. So even if you come to the class, which seems like ostensibly a skillful action, if you come to the class with a chip on your shoulder, or you're listening to the talk with aversion, then, to a large extent, the action that you're taking is causing you suffering. So, what we do with our mind is ultimately what decides our happiness. So, what do we do with our minds? What do we do with our minds? We tend to be preoccupied. The place where we tend to put our minds and focus our minds is on what we sometimes call objects. Objects. So when we talk about objects, what we mean are sense objects. So this is where our focus tends to be with our minds, is putting our mind on objects, on sense objects. So we like to put our minds on visual sights, right? Or sounds, that stereo that guy has, or the tastes, or the way the body feels, the sensations in the body. Oh, the body feels this way, right? The body feels that way. Oh, it's cold today, it's hot today, right? We tend to do that a lot with our minds. Or the body, my God, the body's getting old. Oh, the body's getting sick. We put our minds on that object of the body. or other people's bodies, other objects. I mean, this is all objects. We're all objects. We're all sense objects. We're all of what we see in the room we could put under the category of objects, and this is where we tend to put our attention. Now, of course, the Buddha talks about six sense objects, the sixth sense object being the mental qualities. So that's really where, you know, we put a lot of our attention, because even with those other six those other five qualities, there's putting the mind on, the piece of cake, but then there's the thinking about the piece of cake. The thinking about the sense objects, and then of course there's all the mental objects that we put our minds on again and again. And this is where we tend to put a lot of our attention on our aversion, our anxiety, and then the thoughts that come out of that, the perceptions, the thinking. This is where we tend to put our minds most of the time. I think about where you put your mind today. Probably a lot of it was on thinking, the mental objects of thinking. The way that you feel emotionally, there's probably a lot of focus on that, either willingly or probably largely not witting, unwittingly, I mean, if you were agitated during the day, that basically means is that, that's where your mind was landing, and you were putting your attention there and holding on to that experience of agitation in the body. You probably didn't even realize that you were doing it if it was subtle. So we really look to these objects for our happiness. We look to these objects for our happiness. If it's, the piece of cake or the thinking, and the thinking may be around, we look to the objects for happiness perhaps in the way of, I got to figure out what I got to do, that kind of thing. So we're preoccupied with these objects, these sense objects, the internal sense objects of our physical experience in the body, of our emotional experience, our mental experience, and then of course the external objects, other people, what other people do, the sights and smells and tastes that we experience. And you just walk down 14th Street and see how preoccupied with objects you are. The sounds, the people, the thoughts about the people and the sounds. This is where, what we do with our minds. And the problem, of course, is that these objects only, we go to these objects out of habit, but because we believe that going to them in whatever way is going to lead us to happiness, but they can't bring us a true happiness. Any happiness that they bring us is very limited. Because these objects, and of course this is what we're asked to see, are unsatisfactory. They're unsatisfactory. Well, what does that mean? They're impermanent. They're impermanent. They don't last. They're out of our control. I mean, if you had control over the objects, that would be one thing. If you had control over the body and the sensations in the body, I mean, you can take medicine and everything, but your control over it is limited. Your control over what arises in terms of mental qualities is quite limited. It's completely limited, really. You didn't wake up this morning, as one of my teachers used to say, and say, today's a good day for some anxiety. Let me have some anxiety today. So the problem's not the anxiety. The problem is that's where you put your attention. That's what you're grasping onto. Problem isn't the sensations in the body don't feel good or the fact the body is aging, but that's what we're grasping onto. problem isn't the sound out on the street, but that's what we're grasping onto. And the thing about these objects is we grasp to them, and they're, you know, very graspable, you know, or the term that we use sometimes is they're clingable. So they lend themselves to grasping after because they're impermanent in large part. Because they're impermanent. So we grasp after them, they pass, and then we have to grasp after them again. And we grasp after them again, and grasp after them again. And this is what we kind of do. We're kind of this is how we kind of spend our time in this process of grasping after these objects. If it's the thoughts, you know, you have a thought about something you have to do later on in the week, some anxiety arises, there's the thinking that comes out of that. Oh, I don't really want to have to do that. It's going to really be tough, you know? You hold grasp onto that, but it's never, as I was saying yesterday, it's like, that's it. I don't have that thought or that feeling. No, then it arises again and you grasp onto it again. And it's like, you know, because the mind is going, I got to think about this. And you keep grasping onto it, and keep grasping onto it, and keep grasping onto it. So we're preoccupied with these objects, this process of grasping onto, you know, and then the object passes, and we grasp onto it. I mean, it's one thing with, you know, the food that we eat, or the sounds, you know. Or the images on the internet. It's another thing with the thinking and the mental states, you know, because they're moving so fast. So, you know, it's a process that we have to keep holding on and keep grasping and keep grasping and keep grasping and keep grasping after it, even though those things are painful. That's what we do, because we believe that holding on to those thoughts is going to lead us to happiness. So it's like kind of holding on to water, or the image that the Buddha used was sandcastle. You know, we build the sandcastle, the wave knocks it down, we keep building and building and building. And that's this process we live, chasing after these objects, chasing after these objects. So a lot of what concentration practice is enabling us, because we're so enmeshed with those objects, we can't separate out from them and see that they're separate entities, you know, and it's all just objects. So a lot of what concentration practice is being able to see the objects, getting enough space. We can see these are just all objects, they're all impermanent. The issue isn't the objects themselves, but whether or not I'm going to grasp after the objects. That's discernment. So we can think of concentration as getting enough space from the objects so that we can see that they're objects, and discernment is understanding what the objects are, that they're impermanent, they're not self, that they're unsatisfactory, and that if we grasp after them, we're going to suffer. So that's the Buddha's teaching right there. So our practice is really a practice of shifting away from the preoccupation on objects. Shifting away from the preoccupation on objects. Which isn't sort of like what I was bargaining for. You know, I thought it was going to be about just getting rid of the bad objects and only having good objects. Right? That's kind of what we believe, right? But the problem is that is impossible, because objects are always in a flux. Always in a flux of pleasure and pain. If I can just get the body just right, I'll be happy. Impossible. I tried for years. You know, if I could just the right amount of alcohol and drugs and key lime pie and sex, and I'll be happy. Impossible. We all kind of know that. Or the right job or the right person. Can just get the right objects, I'll be happy. Well, what the practice tells us is that we have to turn away from objects, our preoccupation on objects. You know, and it's not so much that we're not going to have objects in our lives, but not to be preoccupied with them or expect that they're going to bring us happiness. Is that job really going to bring you happiness? Or is your mind going to bring you happiness? You know, is that person really going to bring you happiness? Is the way your body is going to bring you happiness? Is having the right emotional states arising going to bring you happiness? But what we learn to do in the practice is shift toward more of a focus on objects that are going to help us move towards true happiness. You know, and the teachings are pretty clear about what those objects are. First of all, it's good thoughts. So thoughts of compassion, thoughts of loving kindness, thoughts of joy. So that's what we focused on today, right? It was those objects, right? I hope. You know, and then the object of the breath, you know, really as the primary object that we seek to, so we can, you know, the breath is a primary object, and then the easeful breath as an object to put our minds on. You know? I mean, these are good objects because they put us in a position to understand objects, largely. But even after we become fully awakened, you know, the Buddha said, it's all right to focus on the breath because it feels good. You don't need to. But, you know, he told the Arhats, you know, it was okay to focus on the breath. So we shift towards good objects. But ultimately our practice is a more and more turning away from objects completely and turning into the place of the unconditioned, the place where there are no objects, which is the heart. And this is where we learn to put our focus and put our minds more and more in the heart. This place, you know, and I mean, this word heart is a little tricky. We could call it the citta, this place of innate wisdom, this place of love and compassion, this place of happiness, you know, that's said to be ever present within us. The word in Pali is akalika, the ever-present truth, or you could think of it as the Dharma inside. This is where we, and you know, because it's ever-present, it's always there. I mean, it was there, it's here, it's there, it's within all of us. It'll be there after you die. It's deathless, it's deathless. That's why when the Buddha died, was dying, he said, my body's dying, but there is that which doesn't die. The Dharma doesn't die. The heart doesn't die. The truth doesn't die. It's always going to be right there. Be a lamp unto yourself. We all have a light inside of ourselves, a lamp inside of ourselves. It's through our practice. And he said, be mindful, develop your mindfulness, learn to put your mind in good places so that you can focus on the light inside of yourself. That's always there, that's a light that doesn't burn out. That's why we call it a true happiness. The Buddha said, the eye is to be abandoned, forms are to be abandoned. The ear is to be abandoned, sounds are to be abandoned. The nose is to be abandoned, aromas are to be abandoned. The tongue is to be abandoned, flavors are to be abandoned. The body is to be abandoned, tactile sensations are to be abandoned. The intellect is to be abandoned, ideas are to be abandoned. When I first heard that one, I was like, man, that sounds really nihilistic. You know, that sounds like what happens? Do I just disappear? Do I just disappear? It took me a long time to, it bothered me, you know, a lot. It bothered me a lot. And part of the reason why it bothered me a lot is part I didn't understand what he was saying, and part I didn't understand that there was something other than the forms, the sounds, the aromas, the flavors, the tactile sensations, and the ideas. There was something else other than objects. There was something else other than those things that are conditioned and die. Because this is what he's saying there. You know, don't be preoccupied. You know, don't be preoccupied with those things. let go little by slowly of your preoccupation with those things and turn to something greater, because those objects can't bring us a lasting happiness. Turn to something that's greater. Turn to the heart. Turn to the light inside of yourself that never goes out. Of course, when we're, you know, so much, as I said, of concentration is about learning to be able to see objects and let go, so that we can let go of objects. Typically, we're not present because we're clinging and holding on to objects, and we're thinking, you know, that thinking that comes out of our clinging. So we live in these thought worlds, this place of becoming. That which is becomes something else. You know, we live in this place of fabricated identity. It's a fiction, or the Tibetans say it's a dream. We live in these thought worlds. As we begin to let go of objects, we begin to, you know, it's like the, you know, little by slowly, you know, the fog begins to lift, and we begin to come more and more into the present moment. And this is when practice kind of starts to get interesting. You know, I mean, it's always interesting, but it's like our relationship to the present moment. Our relationship to the present moment. Because our tendency is to want to do what with the present moment? Fill it with objects. It's like, all right, this is, I'm going to bring my attention right into this moment, and I'm going to make the most out of this moment by having the most sense experience I can have in this moment, right? That's the way that we look at the moment. You know, it's like years and years ago, I had a friend who, like me, she grew up on Long Island. She didn't really have much cultural background, neither did I. And it's like, she said, yeah, let's go to a museum. I've never been to a museum. I wanted to go to the Met, so I'll never forget this. You know, it's like we went to the Met, and she wanted to see every fucking painting in the whole museum. Seriously, I mean, we were there all day. I never was so exhausted in my whole life. But that's kind of how we are, right? You know, that's how we are. It's like, I'm going to fill that moment. I'm going to fill that moment with everything I can. Gonna make the most out of that moment, right? I'm gonna fill it with objects, which never, you know, so most of the time we live in this place of, I didn't make the most out of this moment. You know? Yeah, because we can never be satisfied with objects. And because we can never be satisfied with objects, we go into despair about the fact that we weren't able to fill the moment with those objects. So in the moment, we're still preoccupied with objects, and we try to cram the moment with objects. Now, what's interesting here, of course, is the moment is in itself a fabrication. I mean, the idea of the moment is a fabrication. You know, time in and of itself is a fabrication. We talked about this yesterday. You know? So, I mean, you know, time is convenient. It's a convenient fabrication on the conventional level, you know, but yesterday, that's a fabrication. You know? I mean, 5 minutes ago. I mean, the second, just before I just said this word now, that's just a fabrication. And where is that? Where's the future? It's all a fabrication. It's all an idea. And even the moment, this little bit, this little segment of time is still a fabrication. So what we try to do is we have this little bit of time and we try to cram it with as much as we can. But the moment is a fabrication. And all fabrication is subject to birth and death. All fabrication is subject to birth and death. So that moment, that idea of the moment as a segment of time is inherently unsatisfactory. The present is timeless. present is timeless. It's a place of timelessness. We talked about this yesterday, how children live in the place of timelessness, and I talked about how this is why when we were children, you know, the days just seemed endless and seemed to go by. We think, well, I'm old now and it's all proportional, but it's because children live in this place of timelessness, you know, because they don't cling, and their conception of past and future, of time, isn't developed yet. It's just simply a function of their mind is not developed yet. You know, the three-year-old is like, what am I going to do tomorrow? You know? You know, the three-year-old doesn't say, you know, I got to make the most out of this day. I got to try to accomplish the most today. Just wants to play. Just wants to play. Time isn't a factor because he doesn't know time. She doesn't know time. Oh, I wasted the day. Did you ever hear a 3 year or 4 year old say, I wasted the day. I should have made more out of this day. There isn't even a concept of day or time. Because they are just concepts. So our practice is a practice of turning away from objects, things that come and go, things that are inherently unsatisfactory, including the object of the moment, and turning to things which transcend birth and death, that transcend time and space. This light within us transcends birth and death. It's deathless. And one of the things, you know, the Buddha usually didn't try, I mean, there were some places, and I'll allude to a couple now, where he tried to describe this place and this quality of deathlessness, but the problem, of course, is the only way to describe it is to use objects. So you can't really describe it, because all you have to describe is language and objects. So how can you describe which isn't an object by using objects? Well, you can use metaphors and things like that, but it still doesn't. And the problem, of course, you know, and this is really the biggest reason why he didn't describe it too much, if you use objects to describe it, which is the only way to describe it, then what you're going to do, or his students were going to do, was look for those objects that he described. The teachings describe it, or what the Buddha, one of the ways the Buddha described it was this. There is that dimension where there is neither earth nor water nor fire nor wind, neither this world nor the next world, nor sun nor moon. And there is neither coming nor going nor staying, neither passing away nor arising, unestablished, unevolving. This, just this, is the end of suffering. We've been talking about it as that place of silence. As that place of silence. One more passage. And this is from one of the nuns at the time of the Buddha, Sister Patarakara. And she talked about her experience of awakening, of coming to the light, coming into the light, which is actually, you know, paradoxically, the image, of course, is the putting out of the preoccupation with sense objects, the extinguishing of the burning of the senses. Washing my feet, I noticed the water, and watching it flow from high to low, my heart was composed like a fine thoroughbred steed. Then taking a lamp, I entered the hut, checked the bedding, sat down on the bed. And taking a pin, I pulled out the wick. Like the flames unbinding was the liberation of awareness. Like the flames unbinding was the elimination of awareness. So we unbind from all that's conditioned, all objects. We come to that place of happiness. And this is where we learn to put our minds. This is where we learn to put our minds. So let's just close our eyes for a minute.